You know, maybe perhaps as you yourself have experienced, when you get asked to do something and you feel like it's you know, God asking you, you don't question it. You just kind of do it and you do the best that you can. And so that's sort of what I did.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, we have a very interesting show for you. I think you're going to really enjoy meeting the lady we have on today, not only because she's a lawyer, but also because, you know, we really appreciate mothers. We talk a lot about this, about the importance of the family and motherhood. And she agrees with that. In fact, she feels so strongly about that, that she's very involved in organizing and fighting some of the woke stuff that is attacking families. And she's written a wonderful new book that is gathering esteem and gathering readership and interest all throughout North America. And so we're very excited to have on the show Mandy Knox Sweeney. Thank you for being on the program with us today, Mandy. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Leighton, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
All right. So before we introduce you properly, as we always do, we're going to go to our aphorisms board. And these have been selected somewhat in your honor. Hopefully you're not offended by these, but they have sort of an author flavor. The first one is from C.S. Lewis, who's written many things that are wrote many things that are very quotable. But something that I think sort of applies to your book, I hope. He wrote that someday you'll be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. Secondly, from his friend, J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote that the world is indeed full of peril, and in it there are many dark places, but still there is much that is fair. And though in all lands love is now mingled with grief, it still grows, perhaps the greater. And then perhaps arguably from the world's greatest living author, arguably, J.K. Rowling, as is a tale, so is life. Not how long it is, but how good it is what matters. So who do we have on the show today? Well, Mandy Knox Sweeney. She's an American author. She was born at NATO headquarters in Belgium, of all places, and subsequently moved with her family to Montgomery, Alabama, where she grew up. And she received her undergraduate degree from the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce and then moved to Manhattan to work with a pension fund prior to attending law school. And she's a lawyer now. She lives with her husband and three children in Atlanta, Georgia, where she serves as senior counsel, not because she's old, but because she's experienced for a global chemical company and writes fiction in the wee hours of the morning. Welcome to the show, Mandy. So very excited to have you here. I want to start with perhaps some of your background. And this is a question you've probably been asked a lot and maybe you're tired of answering, but what was it that drew you to the study of law and to the legal profession?
You know, at Leighton, nobody has asked me that. You are the first person on all these interviews that has asked me about why I studied law. And I think that in the United States, the answer for me was that it's just so proliferate. It touches everything. And I actually, the rest of my family all is in medicine. So my father had been head otolaryngologist for NATO. That's why I was born in Belgium. Mm-hmm. My brother is a radiologist in New Orleans. And I initially started kind of going down the avenue of law to do med mal defense because the medical malpractice in the United States has been quite turning for the country and the medical profession. And a lot of doctors are struggling and they have to do a lot of backup, you know, recordings and things like that, that ultimately the patients kind of got the raw end of the deal because the doctors are having to do all of this CYOA. So that's initially why I went to law school, was to do the med mal defense. And additionally, I had worked in New York with a pension fund and I was doing commercial real estate and I was surrounded by all of these like 400 page commercial real estate documents, none of which I like could fully understand. And I figured I would,
who can?
and figure it out for myself. And so for those two reasons, I primarily went. I did realize about myself that I am not particularly litigious. I believe you are a litigator. Are you a, you litigate,
yes.
correct?
Okay. Yes.
So it takes a certain personality, I think, to gravitate towards that. And I admire it. I just am not, it wears on me. The adversarial nature mm-hmm. of it, I find to be very wearing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I realized pretty early on that I had a good mind for transactional. I'm very business oriented. I'm a good numbers person. I was a finance and international business major in undergrad. And it kind of just dovetailed well into my background. Mm-hmm. So that is a long answer to your question.
Interesting. And you said you're a mother of three, and you're working now as in-house counsel. Is that right? What type of legal work are you doing right now? And what sort of drew you to that?
Yeah. So I had been with Big Law, so an Am Law 100 firm. And I'm sure you know a bunch of attorneys yeah. that are at Am Law 100 firms. Yeah. And mm-hmm. you build your life in 6-minute increments. And it just is not very conducive to having a family. And so at some point, I evaluated it and I thought, well, in-house would be great to go into. For a number of different reasons, I also found, so Am Law 100 firms, you can get kind of pigeonholed. You're doing work that is high dollar value and kind of like time sensitive, but not always that intellectually engaging. And yeah. in-house, you know, you do get to kind of touch all aspects of the company. And a lot of, you know, what I do is, especially because we're a private company, I mean, we're privately held large international company. And you do get to kind of like take more of a, have some more input in the strategic direction of the company. You touch all the different aspects. So you touch sales, you touch R&D, you touch, you know, everything. So you get a nice bird's eye view. And it tends to be, there are aspects of it that can be quite fun. Mm-hmm. I would say, Leighton, my passion is the writing. My passion is this book. And my legal work supports me being able to do my passion.
Well, that's whatever works, and obviously it's great that it is, because you've just produced a wonderful book, and we're going to talk about that in depth. But just one more question on the legal lines before we get into that, because by way of segue, one of the themes of the book, and I have read part of it. I've gotten through the first few chapters, but one of the themes of the book, as I understand it, is you're trying to present, or you are presenting, a different view to, especially to adolescent people, but also to everyone. It's not your book, I think, is not necessarily specific to adolescents, but a view that is inconsistent with what people are receiving right now in the industry. In terms of wokeness and talking about the legal profession, by way of segue, I want to get your take on this. Obviously, we're very blessed to have incredible female legal minds right now in the world, in places like United States and Canada, and historically. But having lived through the experience of being at a big firm, would you agree with me that to a large degree, that world is in a real sense, in a lot of ways, anti-family? In other words, the expectations that are placed upon women in that environment are very much contrary to being able to raise a family. Would you agree with that? And is that part of the, you know, I see that really sort of, you know, blending in with the whole, you know, feminism, which blends out into a lot of the woke streams, or do you think I'm on the wrong track there?
No, I don't think you're on the wrong track. I would say I don't think it's directed at women. I think that the Am Law 100 big firm life is difficult for family life for men and women.
Yeah, true.
And anymore, because of the necessity for two individuals in a family, like both parents, to typically work. Yeah. You know, that affects the men just as much as it affects the women anymore at these big firms. And I do think traditionally law firms, the structure was that you'd build a book of business and then you would pass it to the associates and you would nurture them and they would kind of move up. But anymore, the firms have gotten so big that the equity partners probably don't have the same financial incentive to pass to really nurture and bring people up, it more behooves them to kind of have somebody who's very, very competent in whatever it is that they're doing and sort of keep them there, because advancing that person, because you have so many equity partners to share the additional, you know, profit, you just don't have the same incentives that you used to when the firm structure was first conceived. Yeah. So yeah. I think that there's just a fundamental flaw in the structure, and there's been a lot of thought as to where it goes. But I do want to say, like, there's benefits to the big firms in that I was surrounded, and most people probably at large firms can say, you're surrounded by really sharp individuals. The talent is exceptional, and you get to work on very sophisticated projects. So it's not like it's all gloom and doom.
Right.
It's sort of like living in New York. I lived in New York for a while. It's something to do, and it's an experience. It might not be what you want to do for your entire life. it's a special person that can kind of, especially for a woman, and I'd have to say, and it might just be me, but I do not know any equity partners that are women that have a family that are married. I just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, part of that, and this is maybe what I was driving at, is Dr. Jordan Peterson talks about this because he represented a lot of women, really high end women, you know, corporately in his clinical practice. And he said, one of the big differences for women versus men is that just biologically, if we're allowed to say that anymore, women have this smaller window in which to start a family. And you know, that we call the biological clock. Men, you know, they have a longer window, and that does in some ways discriminate against women, because of course, you know, if you're a 25-year-old woman gets out into legal practice, and you know, you've got basically what, maybe a 10-year window to have your kids, and during that same time, you know, you're just starting out and trying to build your legal career. So that's kind of what I was driving at. But I appreciate your answer. It's very insightful.
So, Leighton, I think too, so what you said speaks to also in the pandemic, what you saw is women dropping out. I mean, ultimately, and that women and men are different, and the brunt of the family still falls typically.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Because the woke people, they dispute that, don't they?
If you want to talk about the crazy transgender stuff going on, I can definitely speak to that as well.
That is where we're going. We're going to talk about your book. I want to get you taken on that too, because obviously you have some keen insights there. But talking about your book, so obviously you're very well educated. You're from a very high IQ family. You're going along finding your career, but you decide, you know, this, you really want to do this writing. When did you get started with your writing, and specifically with fiction? Is this something that you did back when you were in high school and college, and then you just sort of have taken it up more seriously now? What was the sort of the genesis of your muse to become an author?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So I've always liked to write, but that had nothing to do with picking it up right now. And I was managing editor for my law review when I was in law school. I mean, I am familiar with writing, and as an attorney, we write all the time. Right. But after the birth of our third child, I had a health issue. And I, for a period of time, thought that there was a high likelihood that I would, based upon what I was being diagnosed with on my blood work, I would die in a short period of time, and my quality of life would be pretty bad. And I think in common with probably a lot of people on your show in past and other areas of life you've come across, when you have that experience, it can be a real gift because it's a reprioritization. Mm-hmm. And around that time, so I had these three young kids and a loving husband. And around that time, I came out and I realized that, okay, no, I don't have this. You know, I'm okay. I have something, but it's not this. And I felt very powerfully spiritually tapped to write a glorification of God book that was accessible to middle grade children and above. And it's kind of funny, Leighton, because I felt very driven to do this, and I knew the emotion that I wanted to evoke with it. And I kind of had a loose storyline, but I had no idea how to get from that idea to a book and long form fiction. But, you know, maybe perhaps as you yourself have experienced, when you get asked to do something and you feel like it's, you know, God asking you, you don't question it. You just kind of do it and you do the best that you can. And so that's sort of what I did. And I started this kind of deep dive into it. And I got really lucky in that the pandemic happened, and the pandemic, for however, so many negative, awful things. One thing that was a positive is that seminars are that you had to previously attend in person. You could attend virtually. So there was this great writing seminar that typically would take place in Bath, England, and it went virtual with the pandemic. And I was able to tune into it, and it had all these, you know, authors and literary agents and publishers and people presenting. And so I got a really nice insight into writing, and specifically with respect to fiction writing, to kind of like jump from. And then I would say too, it took me years to write this book. It took me years to find a voice. It took me years to get to a place to write something long form fiction that someone else might want to read for fun. But each time I kind of hit a roadblock, I would pray about it, and an answer pretty clearly would come about. And there are any number of instances along the way that were pretty improbable, where people came in and helped and kind of got this particular project to the next stage. And that kind of still is happening. I mean, I'm having conversations about film and some of these things that are very outside my arena, but are growing real legs. And I mean, I personally think it was just because this was God's project, and he taps people you wouldn't necessarily suspect. And I'm very grateful to play a part of it.
Wow. So you had the best muse of all. You've been called to this by God. The book is called The Magi of Miriam, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom. I want to get you to not necessarily give away what the book is about, but before we go there, I'm an English major. Okay. So my first degree, I wrote an honors thesis in Shakespeare. So I'm, you know, when I read books, I'm reading it from that point of view. And I read a lot of books, and I'm curious to know, what sort of books influenced your construction of the themes and the motifs and the plot lines in this book? Were you calling upon, you know, things like, you know, C.S. Lewis and the Narnia series, or were you looking at, you know, J.K. Rowling? Were you looking at Lord of the Rings, things like that? Or where were your ideas coming from to sort of construct this book?
Yeah. So I pitched this book to the publisher as Narnia meets Hunger Games. And
wonderful.
I was heavily influenced by C.S. Lewis, but it was actually Screwtape Letters that I was more influenced than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or more of his children's fiction. I was also, so this will tell you a lot about me, but my favorite book of all time is not a kid's book. It's Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. I like the teetering on insanity. I like not reality, realities you can build, that kind of speaks to me. And so I was heavily influenced by those writers. And then after I had written the first draft, which was garbage, right? I mean, after I had written the first couple drafts of the manuscript, somebody told me, some editor had reviewed it for me and was like, well, you need to go back and read some stuff in the genre. So then I went back and I read the Harry Potter series, which are amazing. I mean, they're just so fanciful and wonderful and engaging. Yeah. But I did that not so much to form a plot. And I was sort of grateful that I didn't have that, because you don't want too much commonality. Yeah. But it did help me frame how to kind of write the writing a little bit more to be more accessible to younger age groups. I would say I also made a conscious decision in writing this book not to dumb down the vernacular too much. Mm-hmm. I tried to make it accessible and not flowery, but I didn't choose, you know, short words just because you might have a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old reading this book. And a quote that I like to give a lot to add to your quotes that you began with from C.S. Lewis is, Since it is so likely that children will meet cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. Otherwise, you are making their destiny not brighter but darker. And that's a quote from C.S. Lewis that I give a lot when I'm talking about the book, because it really does give an explanation as to why I wrote this series. I was not finding things in children's literature that were traditionally commonplace. I was not finding uplifting messaging. I was not finding glorification of God. And I wasn't even finding like complex stories that were challenging the reader. You know, I don't want to name any series, but a lot of the books that I was picking up with our kids that were popular were sort of, you know, I felt like I was getting dumber as I was reading it with them. And so why is that the case? And that was not always the case in our society. I mean, right. Back 50 years ago, children's literature was much more complex. And you mm-hmm. said, you mentioned Shakespeare, who you did a deep dive on. So I also loved what Shakespeare did to write to different demographics. So right. I actually did that in this book. There's theological layers in this book mm-hmm. that are designed to speak to you know, older individuals, more so than children, or at least they pick up on it more. There's a very strong free choice theme that runs through this book. There's, you know, temptation. There's themes that adults understand because, quite frankly, we've lived a little bit longer and experienced some of that a little bit more than children. But mm-hmm. then I've told the story, or at least I've attempted to tell this story in a fairly fast-paced action and adventure to still engage young readers.
Yeah.
So.
Wonderful. You know, the best stories I find, period, and you've talked about a couple of them, but the ones that engage me the most, and I think especially engage young readers, are stories that deal with problems of good and evil. You know, the first novel that I can recall reading as a kid that really drew me in was The Count of Monte Cristo. If you know that story, it's about this 17-year-old guy. He's in love. He's wrongfully accused, thrown in this prison. And then just through you know, providence, he gets to you know, serve a revenge as a dish served cold to everyone who wronged him. But then in the end, he finds that it's dissatisfying, and that the real gift is forgiveness. But stories like that are not being written for children anymore. So I'm very, very pleased and excited to hear that there's authors out like you out there who are producing work like this. But I'm curious to know, obviously, what's going on in our libraries, especially school libraries, is very concerning. And this has been a huge hot topic, not only in the United States, but in Canada. Why do you think that some of the traditional books, the great works even, are being excluded from the view of our children, and having these other types of books, the ones that you described, that make them dumber, that corrupt their morals, are being added in their place? What do you think is behind all of that?
Well, it depends upon how conspiracy theorist you want to get.
You go wherever you want to go.
There is a thinking that there's a deliberate push to make us dumber so that we depend upon the government and can't find our way out of a paper bag. So that's one theory that's been posited. And then there is just this general push towards these wokeisms, these woke narratives. And there's not really a place for, you know, if you're pushing transgender and you're pushing hypersexualization, that is counter to the traditional books that are glorification of God. I mean, they're directly a conflict. So you can't really house them both. If you're having somebody who's doing the selections, they're not going to pick up their traditional book. So I think that is playing a part. Mm-hmm.
Now I'm curious, it doesn't sound like it, but I'm curious to know, it was part of your inspiration to write the book as a response to that, or was it more a situation that this was just what you really wanted to write about, and this is just what came out of you artistically?
So it's hard for me to piecemeal that apart, because I felt so spiritually tapped that I should write it. But at the same time, part of my thinking was, I'm not seeing this in the mix. So it's, I don't think if I had not felt such a calling to write the Glorification of God book that I probably would have followed through with it, only because to write a fiction book and take the time to actually think somebody's going to want to read it, you either have to be extremely arrogant or you have to think that you're being asked to do it for a reason, a message that you really want to convey. And I felt that I had to do this because I felt like I was being spiritually tapped to do it. So I would say it's probably a confluence of things, but if I had not felt so spiritually like driven, then I don't know that I would have been able to make it through like 6 years of different revisions and different blockades to get to publication. Right. So it's, I don't know if I've answered your question, but
you have. I was just thinking that if you're going to turn this into a series, you're going to have to live a really long time. And I hope that you I pray that you do.
Yeah. It is a series. It's a trilogy, but I already know how it's supposed to end. And there is a learning curve. And I have to say, no matter how talented somebody is, if you pick up fiction writing, I think that there is this kind of like grueling process to find a voice. And I do think once you have done that and put in the time and the energy, that your next book is probably infinitely easier.
Yeah. If everybody could do it and do it well, then everybody would do it, right? I mean, there's a reason why we, you know, the great books, a good book is so precious because, it's the rarity. So God bless you for producing this. Your publicist, though, I've done you a disservice because when I discovered you, it was because I saw an email that said, "Can America's mom save the kids from the woke Marxists?" From talking to you, it doesn't sound like that was really your mantra. But why don't you tell us a little bit about this really fascinating story? Who's Jesse Walker? Tell us a little bit about Jesse and your protagonist in the story and a little bit about what he goes through in your book.
So Jesse is 12 years old, and he's a pretty average kid. He's got the same insecurities that many other, starting to be hormonally charged 12-year-olds would have. He's got friend insecurities, but he has friends. He has lost his mom, so he has some insecurities surrounding the loss of his parent. But he, for the most part, is a pretty humble, likable character. And kids, I have gotten feedback that kids tend to be able to identify with both him and Ionia, his co-protagonist, pretty well. Now, he does have this talent, this gift that he doesn't discover until later in the book. But for the most part, he's just a humble character. And I will touch, Leighton, about, because you mentioned the publicist and how he built me out. I mean, it is a Glorification of God book, and Glorification of God and Marxism is completely a conflict. So I actually don't mind him,
I was only kidding. I was only kidding. He's great. I love who he is. Well, I wouldn't follow him if he didn't introduce me to wonderful people like you. So I was just making a bit of a joke.
And America's Mom, the comment on America's Mom, I've been asked, how did you get the America's Mom name? And my answer typically has been that America must be very accepting. Because I'm not a great cook. And my kids would find it funny. But I think just as most parents, we're all a little bit winging it and just trying to do the best that we can for our children.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about something about the way you've structured the story, though, because obviously, motherhood is something that's very important to you, central to your life, and yet in your story, your protagonist loses his mother. Was there sort of an artistic purpose in that? What was part of the message there? It seems strange that or odd that you would be writing a book that is promoted as is promoting motherhood. And then your protagonist in the story loses his mother. There's obviously an important purpose in that, why you did that. Do you want to explain about that a little bit?
Yes. So when I had first conceived of the Magi of Miriam and had just been through that kind of health experience, I had had many thoughts of what would I want to impart to my children if I wasn't here? And it was the messaging that really, so you read the beginning of the book, there's a letter at the very start that basically says, you are everything you need to be. That is something that I would have written my kids if I wasn't around to tell them myself. And so I actually have found that adults who have lost a parent, this book speaks to them because of that kind of dynamic that runs through the book. And so Jesse, he has the very human reaction against his mom as to why did she leave me? Why would she leave me? There's also like a more complicated thing because this is a fantasy book. So his mother had this alternate life in this other world and she had not filled him in on it. And then he gets thrown into that other world in this cataclysmic good and evil battle. So that's the crux of the story.
Right.
But he has this insecurity. Why did she not love me enough to did she not trust me to kind of clue me into this whole other life that she had? So he has these insecurities. And I think that the messaging, once you get through the book and the journey, is that he, aside from understanding more of how God is a component of him and his life, and that he develops an understanding that his mother kind of shielded him, rightly or wrongly, because she didn't want her child to be in danger. And those are all themes that play very, very pointedly for mothers, for parents, for both men and women, for, you know, fathers and mothers. So while the mother has been, you know, she's not alive for the duration of the book, there's a lot of, a lot surrounds her, and she's a very, very prevalent character in the book.
Right. So we don't want to give away what he discovers is a superpower, but as I read the story, it sounds like a sort of a quest where he's on this journey where he's going after something, and he doesn't really understand fully until he gets to the end of the journey what he's been after all along. What's interesting about this, though, about your story as you describe it, is that you're imbuing characteristics and putting your character in situations where he has to exhibit traits that don't seem to be promoted very much for our young people, one of them being self-reliance, things like faith, right? Things like overcoming adversity and finding ways of solving problems, building relationships with other people where you help and they help you. These are really important things in the lives of young people and really in the lives of everyone, but they're not really being emphasized in literature that our kids are reading, are they? Was that part of your purpose and the way that you were, as you were writing, or was that just sort of a natural outgrowth of the way that you were depicting the story?
No, that was 100% part of the purpose. I am so tired of victimization. I am so tired of victimization. Jesse and Ionia, they have to overcome real challenges. They have to. And just like the C.S. Lewis quote, let's arm our kids, because you're going to come across danger and evil, and you can't be the victim. That's not going to get you anywhere. So put your big boy pants on and go in there and figure it out. So absolutely, that was running in the theme of this story.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I appreciate about this book, too, and, you know, at the risk of giving offense to some people, is that It's a positive depiction of a boy, of a male character, and I think throughout the literary canon, the Western literary canon, obviously we have all manner of wonderful female characters. It's arguable that perhaps women and girls are underrepresented in that canon, but I'm finding that today very few authors are writing books or stories that are focused on a young man or a boy like this. It seems as though, and Harry Potter, I guess, would be an exception. But are you finding that do you agree with me about the genre that, and was that part of your purpose in having your protagonist a boy? Was there method in that, or was that just the way you envisioned the story?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. I did not really think that one through as much. I knew that I did not want this to be for just boys or just girls. Right. And I didn't, in fact, I write under M.K. Sweeney because I didn't want anybody to not want to pick it up because they thought I was a man or a woman. And I'm not trying to make everybody androgynous. we're not. but I wanted it to, this book is not about your sex. This book is right. about glorification of God, empowerment, triumph over insecurities. And I don't care whether it's a boy and I don't care whether it's a girl. And frankly, I have a son and I have daughters. And I think this is the messaging is important for both. Yeah. Yeah. So,
but your key characters here are obviously are male and female, and each of them have characteristics, traits that are somewhat representative of who they are, being a male or female, and part of your message is that that's okay. In fact, that's really what makes life interesting. That's the way God made us. God made us in His image, the Imago Dei. And His image, God is neither male or female. He's beyond that. But He created us, men and women, boys and girls. I think part of your story is about embracing that, and that boys and girls don't need to feel uncomfortable and get hung up on all this stuff, feeling uncomfortable in their own skin. At least that's the impression I have, which is very refreshing. Because a lot of the books being written right now for kids are just seems to be all about, sexualization, all about, distorting or erasing the difference between the wonderful differences between men and women. Would you agree?
Yes. And it's funny because you use the phraseology comfortable in your own skin. And I actually use that phraseology when I talk about the book. If the reader comes away wonderful. More comfortable in his or her own skin, then I will have done a good job with this book. And yeah. you're touching on, that's how God created us. Yes. And so, there's so much of this androgenization, and you probably saw the Pope came out last Friday speaking yes. against the transgender issues and things wow. like that. And it is very much, we were created as man and woman. And the idea that we're in the wrong body, so gender dysphoria or gender identity, is contrary to creation and God's intent. Mm-hmm. Like God doesn't make mistakes. Yeah. And then if you're just hitting on that particular issue, which is being so blown out of proportion, I mean, true gender dysphoria is such a small percentage of the population.
Right.
It's like 2 to 3 women in 100,000 and then 5 to 12 men in 100,000 based upon the American Psychiatric Association numbers. Now, I've seen other studies that say that bizarrely, is 5,000 times more than that based upon in the past 5 years. What happened to people's genetics? I don't know. But so this androgenization and how it's being positioned, this transgender, that we're this androgynous being and it doesn't matter whether you're a man or woman. And it's very disturbing because it is a stripping of identity. And what is wrong with being how we were created? I mean, the messaging is quite perverse. And this book is against that. I mean, it is like, you are who you are and you're beautiful and, overcome your insecurities with that so you can triumph and enjoy the joy that how God created us.
Mm-hmm. We talk about the promotion of transgenderism in young people. I'm interested to get your take on this because you're obviously very alive to it. It's my impression that this transgender ideology or cult, if we can call it that, seems to be an oblique attack upon womanhood. Abigail Schreier wrote a brilliant book about this. You probably read it, called Irreversible Damage, about how it used to be that transgenderism used to be something that was characteristic of, middle-aged guys, like, well, I guess Caitlyn or Bruce Jenner, but now it seems to be all the focus is on young girls, especially adolescent girls. I've never been one, but you would know more about this. But Abigail Schreier talks about this in her book about, that's such a confusing time, a difficult time, maybe especially for girls. And they're so vulnerable to this ideology. I wonder, do you agree with that, that perhaps as this transgender ideology sort of unfolds, it becomes more and more an attack on women in terms of using men to portray women in advertisements like Bud Light and Doritos, or the invasion of men into women's spaces like sports and bathrooms and things like that. It seems to be that women are really suffering and girls are suffering the brunt of this more than anyone. What's your take on that?
So I haven't thought about it as a girl versus the boy thing. I can see it now that you're talking about it. I've just thought of it more as a kind of societal push and conditioning that is currently happening in schools and elsewhere. And yeah. I mean, it's not about the people themselves. This is not about the people suffering from gender dysphoria. It's not. I mean, the people who are proponents of this are going under the guise that it's to prevent teenage suicide, but they're not looking at TikTok or, you know, how the pandemic shutdowns affected tweet teens, or, you know, violent video games that actually have more of a direct correlation. So, but the conditioning that we're all the same, does that affect women more than men, girls more than boys? And I guess it could, only because there's so much as a hormonally charged pubescent girl, and they're scared about getting their periods. And now in Atlanta, in some of the progressive schools, what they've done is they have this sex ed talk that was bumped from sixth to fourth grade. And then they have them as co-ed. So they have the boys and girls in these groups together. And because they want, it shouldn't matter whether it's a male or a female teacher, they have like a guy teacher teaching these kids about like sex ed. And these girls are sitting next to like the guys in their class, listening to this guy teacher talk about like your vagina. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing. And as a girl, I mean, they just shut down. I mean, first of all, it's already such an awkward idea and it's scary, like getting your period as a prepubescent. I think about it, bleeding and things like that. That's fear. It's scary. Your body is going through all these changes you don't understand.
I couldn't even imagine it.
Neither can I. No, I'm kidding. It's not.
Why
fun.
Would any? I can't imagine why any man would want to go through that. I mean, but the thing is, in Canada, it's even worse. I mean, our government has ordered that they have to put menstrual products in men's bathrooms because, of course, the messaging is. They're trying to push things as truth that we know are lies, that men can menstruate, which is, we understand is absurd.
Yeah.
That men can become women, women can become men. We know these are lies, but these lies are being indoctrinated into our youth so that they'll sort of accept the 2 + 2 = 5. But if they do that, that's going to what you're saying is that's going to estrange them from truth, which is going to then estrange them from God, right?
Yes, I mean I do think that this is very much an attack on God. It is hard to, because it's saying that creation is fallible. It's saying that we can be trapped in the wrong body and things like that. And saying that is saying that God made mistakes. So it's a direct attack on God. The conditioning and why, for instance, I think the WHO might be pushing some of this stuff.
Yes.
Right. And so like you're trying to get, what's the end game here? Cause it does, like I said, the numbers are not there to support that it's the people who suffer from this psychiatric condition. So it's about the rest of us. And I mean, it really should be, why exactly are they doing this? What's the end game here? So, I mean, but right now we're dealing with like the Doritos thing, like you referenced, and that is a weird one because it was just, unlike the Bud Light transvestite, it was the person who Doritos chose had put out these really hateful statements. I don't know if you had read them, but she basically had condoned raping minor girls. So that would play into your thinking on like, this is affecting women more than men. And she, at some point, because I had an interview and this touched on this, she had written, women who are victims of rape and who go to self-help centers to overcome their trauma are terrible. Like, I hate women who are victims of rape and who turn to self-help centers to overcome their trauma. She wrote that. That's a very hateful statement. That's a very hateful statement.
Yeah.
She also, somewhat not surprisingly, and Doritos might have known about this one, she was a self-proclaimed Marxist, and she had made statements that the abolition of and to destroy and annihilate the traditional monogamous nuclear family were her goal. So, you know, you got to take a step back and think, wow, this is what, it, you know, somebody who is being put out there as a marketing persona. And so, in, curious, in her particular instance, you know, with the transgender stuff, a large percentage of the individuals are heterosexual. And it seems that those individuals seem to have more of a proclivity towards fetishes. And that would be seem directly in line with maybe what was going on with this particular individual, Samantha Hudson, who I think was born Ivan. But yeah, it's just really crazy. But here again, you don't want to talk too much about the individual because these are people with psychiatric disorders. Right. It's really the conditioning of the rest of us that is the concern and the attack on God.
Yeah. And you were talking earlier about Marxism and how Marxism is antipodal to the family, antipodal really to freedom, antipodal to human flourishing, and against fundamentally against God generally. And Matt Walsh is a commentator you probably know of in the United States, who's talked about this and written a book and a documentary called What is a Woman, where he puts forth this this thesis. I'm curious, though, why you think that progressivism as a religion has taken such deep root in places like the United States and Canada, especially with people like teachers. You know, I grew up when I grew up a generation or two ago in school, excuse me, you know, we cited the Lord's Prayer before we started class every day. I don't remember anybody ever being hurt by that. But so why do you think that there's such a focus on children and such an emphasis on progressivism in our education? I'm interested to get your take on that as a children's author.
So I think that, and I'll answer it in two parts. I think that the push towards progressive and the identity politics is because we all are imprinted by God and we have this spirituality, but a lot of individuals are kind of pushing back on this and they're atheists and they need something to fill that void. And so they need to take up something that they feel passionate about to fill that void. As far as school systems, I don't want to push it all on the teachers, especially in America, because, you know, we had the No Child Left Behind and then we had Common Core. And a lot of this is kind of tying teachers' hands and taking it out of the teachers and the parents' ability to control. And so I think what you have is a lot of teachers that probably would agree with a lot of the things that we're discussing here. But their hands are tied and they have, you know, from the administration, which is ultimately coming from the government and funding, certain limitations with what they can and cannot do in their classroom. Yeah. And I do think if you talk to a lot of these teachers, they're suffering as much with it and they're more upset, if not just as upset about it as we are.
That's a great insight. You know, and I find that same, what you just said, also applies to the legal profession. Obviously, small L liberalism seems to be sort of a dominant idea or ideology in the legal profession and through the judiciary. But still, there are a lot of lawyers, a lot of good lawyers who don't like what's happening and, you know, would speak out against it, but, you know, are afraid to do so or really don't know what to do about it. They don't know what they can. They haven't been inspired to write a wonderful book yet. That's a great insight. And I appreciate you saying that. But, you know, coming back to your main audience of your book, young people. They really are being bombarded right now with this cultural Marxism. And you know, thinking of, for example, Disney is an example of this. I'm curious to get your take on this. Disney keeps putting out really bad children's entertainment. And of course, they might have been the best example of what can be done with children's entertainment, some of their classic movies. But they don't seem to care that the stuff that they're producing isn't being appreciated by their audience. In fact, I saw the CEO recently say, well, you know, it's just because, you know, people are, it's your fault if you don't like our stuff because, you know, your tastes are all wrong. which seems really strange. It's sort of like going to a restaurant and the chef blaming you because you don't like his soup. But why do you think Disney doesn't seem to care that the entertainment they're producing is not being enjoyed by their audiences? What do you think's at work there?
Well, there's a war going on at Disney right now. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the activist investor and the CEO and then the family coming out in support of the CEO.
I just follow what Christopher Ruffo publishes and he sort of some of the stuff, but I'm interested to get this inside take.
Yeah, Disney's in a full-out war. And in large part, I mean, I think all of Hollywood is kind of reconciling with profits that are plummeting because they have produced these shows and movies with kind of wokeness, like they are not satisfying a large portion of their audience. And so they have stopped going to the movies. Disney specifically, I think that their latest mandate is trying to get back to, they're saying recapture the magic, which is what they had before they went woke.
Yeah.
But I think that it's going to be really fascinating to see what they specifically do. I mean, the activist investor at Disney was trying very much to take it away from the CEO because they too are unhappy with what has been produced, just like you are. And I do want to comment, Leighton, on something that you said before, because I think this is incredibly important for your viewers. And you had said about, you know, they haven't written a book to kind of talk to the glorification of God and things like this. And this is something right now that is plaguing our society. And I think all of us need to start speaking out. We all need to have these conversations. This should not just be the author who's on the show or, you know, somebody who has the podcast. We should be having these conversations, whether it's about, you know, conservative politics or whether it's about God, which it's almost like taboo to talk about God anymore. It is up to us to have these conversations. And if you don't, you don't have a lot of room to complain. So I really think that it doesn't matter, you know, in what form you do it. If you go to the public library and read like a C.S. Lewis instead of whatever woke thing is on the floor, you know, there are ways for every single one of us to get involved. And if we were to all do that, this tide would turn pretty stinking quickly.
This this reminds me of what you just said. Reminds me of something. I was at a talk. A friend of mine was giving a talk to a group of people. And he asked everyone who thought that, who was concerned about what was happening at their local school libraries to raise their hands. And of course, almost everybody raised their hands. They said, okay, well, how many of you have recently joined your local library board? And no hands went up. And so you make a really brilliant point. And part of the problem, I think, is that people don't realize that they have something wonderful to offer. I mean, God makes us all special. We're all made in his image. We all have something unique to offer. Not everyone has the talent to be simultaneously a mother of three, a lawyer, and an author. But that doesn't mean that they don't have something special and unique to offer to their family, to their friends, to their community, to their country, to their church. And I think that's a wonderful message that you give. One thing that we could be doing as parents, especially, is opposing, you know, the school ban of classic novels, which seems to be more out of laziness than ignorance. Is this something that you're concerned about? Obviously, you know, you're a literary person. Are you concerned that some of the great books, like the ones you described, are disappearing from our libraries? It seems, you know, something like, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, or, you know, Mark Twain, you know, the writings of Mark Twain. How can those be bad books for kids? It really astonishes the imagination. What are your thoughts about this book banning that's going on?
I am very concerned about it. I also think that it is such a limitation on children's ability. Like, if you think you have to ban this book because you think that kids are going to misinterpret, because Mark Twain used certain phraseology that was commonplace back then, but you don't think that the kid who's reading it can understand that it was commonplace back then, but you don't do it anymore and it's bad now. I mean, what kind of reflection of that is on the intelligence of a child?
But there's worse language in the music that they're listening to.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. I mean, you can let them and get behind that, but you can't let them read Mark Twain. And so I did kind of have a funny kind of exchange with my publicist that we just need another Dr. Seuss novel to get banned for me to have, you know, I'll be on Fox tomorrow. But It's very troubling. It's very troubling. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
I agree with you about Dr. Seuss. In fact, in Canada, I think we're living through the storyline of Yertle the Turtle. In any event, we're at the point in our show where we turn to something called the reading list, which I know you'll appreciate. And so what we do here, and I understand you were kind enough to watch a couple episodes of the show, so you know this is what we do, as I'm going to recommend a couple of books. Shocker, one of them is yours. And then we're going to ask you to say, you've already mentioned a couple of wonderful books, but perhaps you could recommend a couple more, or maybe talk about the next one, the one that you're writing now in the trilogy. So the two books that I'm going to recommend today, the first is The Magi of Miriam, and this is our guest's creation, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom. And so this tells a story of Jesse Walker, who's a 12-year-old boy, just trying to adjust to his new life in a place called Eufaula, Alabama, hopefully I said that correctly, with his father and little sister, after the death of his mother. But when Jesse finds a mysterious note from his mother in his backpack one morning, he suddenly finds himself questioning everything he has ever known. What is the land of Miriam, and what does it have to do with him, and why is he being followed? He meets a friend called Princess Ionia, who's been kidnapped by the Gores, who want to find the key to the Book of Good and Evil. And this is this story is about his quest, and in the end, he goes to bed one Friday night. He suddenly finds himself heading off on an adventure to a land where darkness and light are at war. Alicorns exist. Dragons are something to be feared. I always love a story with a dragon. Smaug has to be one of the greatest characters in English literature. But how can he, a simple boy, be of help? And so as we talked about today, a lot of really wonderful themes in here that are traditional, that are really they are representative of the best ideas, the best motifs and themes in literature, I think. And I'm very grateful that our guest has written this book. And I'm also excited to know that there are going to be at least two more. The second book that we talked about a little bit obliquely is part of the Narnia series. It's the first. It's called The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis. And this is, if you have time to read all seven books in the series, you really should. In fact, if you're going to buy them, I'd buy all seven. But this is the first one. And, it has some of the magic in it and some of the elements that I see coming through in our guest book. But this book is the first title in C.S. Lewis's classic fantasy series, which has captivated readers of all ages for over 60 years. And the plot line is, on a daring quest to save a life, two friends are hurled into another world where an evil sorceress seeks to enslave them. But then the lion Aslan's song weaves itself into the fabric of a new land, a land that will be known as Narnia. And in Narnia, all things are possible. Again, we have these characters, these wonderful characters, off on a quest, working together, relying on each other, and relying on spirituality and faith to solve really serious problems that seem to be insurmountable and much beyond their control. But rather than seeing themselves as victims, they see themselves as individuals who have the wherewithal, who have power to make a difference and to challenge evil. And so it's a wonderful book, wonderful series. And so those are our two selections that are going to be added to our reading list today. And so over to our guest for your selections. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to tell us.
All right. I'll do The Brothers of Karamazov by Dostoevsky. It's written in the 1800s in Russia, but it is very prevalent to our political scheme right now. And also, it is known as his more theological, spiritual book.
Yes.
And so the God and... It just is a really beautiful way to kind of see a person's perspective on that. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do The Girl Who Drank the Moon, because it's a great, uplifting, fanciful read for kids. So those will be my two. And Leighton, I want to take 1 second to plug the Audible for The Magi of Miriam, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom.
Please do.
Yeah. It's read by a guy who has got a great voice. He's got like a Johnny Depp voice. It's not read by me. And it makes it come alive and it makes it accessible to younger kids because the Magi of Miriam's 400 pages and has some advanced vernacular, but the Audible is great for long car rides and younger kids can enjoy it too.
I thank you for mentioning that because I love audiobooks. I really do. I especially enjoy them when the author reads their own book, but I appreciate what you say. A great voice can make a big difference. The other thing that we want to mention, I think, is you have your own website where people can visit and find out more about you and your work and things you're involved in and also more about your book. So is that's mksweeney.com, is that right?
No, I think it's, and it's terrible, I don't know this, but it's www.themagi.ofmiriam.com or it's www.magiofmiriam.com.
We'll get the link. We'll get the link correct for people so that they can just click on it and find you. Yeah. Well, this has just been a blessing to sit down and talk with you and to learn more about you, that you're a person, obviously, of great talent and dedication to do all of these many things. You're a very accomplished woman for somebody who's relatively young. I mean, you've overcome also a great deal in your personal struggles. And obviously, this is, I think, is going to be key to your authorship because you have a deep spiritual insight that obviously guides you and your work. And so it was just a pleasure to sit down with you and learn more about you and everything that you're doing. And we wish you much continued success. And we pray that this book will be a bestseller and will end up in every school library in North America. In fact, I'm going to buy a copy and I'm going to donate it to the local, to my nearest school library. I'm going to put that pledge out there right now. And I encourage everyone listening to this to do that.
Oh, thank you, Leighton, for the kind words. And honestly, the pleasure has been all mine. It's been an honor to be here with you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. God bless. Thank you.
Thank you.